This is the Modern Canadian Shooter Podcast, highlighting and talking to the people who are a part of modern gun culture in Canada, with your hosts, Taylor and Patrick.
The more, so ever since we've had John on the show, him and I have built a bit of a, you know, a little bit of a digital friendship, so to speak. And he, like, just the more you learn about the guy, like the only poopy thing in life is that he lives on the opposite side of the second biggest country in the world, because
it's a pain.
It is. Well, versus you have an entire fucking ocean between you and him, but
it's. That gets thankfully, though, I will say the technology does make that a lot smaller, that distance. But No, Jean's he's such a sweet guy. Like, it's funny because I think a lot of people would look at him, you know, he's big bushy beard and really fit into guns. And I think people would assume that he's a lot more gruff or a lot more rough than he is. But he's just he's a big teddy bear and a phenomenal instructor.
Yes.
And just like unendingly enthusiastic.
Yeah. Unendingly enthusiastic and just always looking to learn. Like, he's a very humble guy. He's asked me some training stuff. I've asked him some training stuff, little nuances of what do you do in this situation, yada, yada, yada. And he is just, he's a good all around human being. That's the best way to put it. John is a bright and shining example. My favorite thing too, we'll be talking sometimes, because also his kit is very squared away. And he was telling me, if I remember correctly, he's telling me a story where he's on an FTX with his reserve unit. And, you know, he's rocking aftermarket kit, shit that makes him efficient, stuff that makes him better at his job. Yep. And some dinosaur warrant comes up to him and starts chewing him out. And like talking about that's not an issue. That's going to get you killed. And it's just like, he's telling me this. And I commented in between the story. And I'm like, yeah, because he would know from all of his experiences of putting sandbags in floods for all of his tours of duty versus you actually going to Ukraine and training dudes. And John just goes, I know. But I just take it because what do I know? I'm just a driver. What do I know? And I'm like, oh, you are a better human than I, John. A better human than I.
He's so zen like that, because he will, knowing that he's been, you know, and we can get into it if you want, but like firsthand, he's been in real, honest to God danger, and yet he'll let it roll off him. And that's something that's I love about the guy. It's very admirable. And it suits him, right? Because, or I should say, like, it benefits him to have such an attitude. And I think it's why he is who he is. And it's why he can pick up, you know, anything. When he was out here with us, he met up with some SF guys and was, you know, working with them. And like, these are legit tier one guys that are operating in a conventional war, Ukrainians. And, you know, he's just in there soaking up everything that he can and then passing it out to students. So I love the guy. I'd have him back here in a second, but I know he's back in. So
yeah,
you know, womp, womp.
Womp, womp. Yeah. It's so funny seeing, you know, just to stay on John's dick, because he's just such a good human being. You know, the great thing about social media is you essentially document what's going on in your life. And you look at John pre-Ukraine, and again, super, super switched on dude. But then, yeah, you look at him post-Ukraine, and, you know, the word you mentioned earlier was zen, more zen-like. And I don't know if that's a transformation that happened to him, like, while he was in Ukraine, or if it just happened when he got back or something like that. But now, when I talk to him, and I, you know, just, and just, yeah, like, he seems just way more in tune with life, and just like anything that happens is just water off a duck's back with him. Like, yeah. I think, you know, and you'd probably be able to speak onto this too, but it's something I've had this kind of realization after I went through an event, you know, a life and death event, and, you know, you probably guys recognize it too, and I bet John did too, but when you go through an event, you know, where life is on the line, and you come out, you realize just how insignificant a lot of the other shit in life is. And like now, 100%. It's just like, yeah, if I get yelled at by the warrant officer because he doesn't like that I am wearing this kit, yeah, that's his opinion. He's a dinosaur. Why do I give, you know, I don't give a fuck, really. He's going to be mad, but, you know, I'm going to keep doing what I do. Yeah, it's just, yeah. And just like now, he just, every time I talk to him more and more, he just seems, yeah, more like a fucking Zen master. Just like he lets life flow through him. Yeah, yeah. I just, I love the guy. I love the guy so much.
He was like that before. And I think it's definitely, I think it probably increased it coming out here and like seeing stuff that has real stakes to it. Mm-hmm. And being part of that. Like I know even for me, I got a pretty nasty temper. But what I found is, just the nearest example is in a conversation with a Westerner out here who kind of took the opinion that Ukrainians should be, you know, down on their knees, thankful for the help that the West has provided, and that, you know, Ukrainians couldn't have defended Ukraine on their own. And, you know, I mean, I've been out here since 2018. I was here when the invasion began, and I remember when they stopped the push on Kyiv, and there were no Western tanks. There was no Western artillery, no HIMARS. No, it was just hardcore dudes with really old gear, but a mm-hmm. lot of conviction. And so, you know, it really pissed me off hearing this guy say this. But I remember I started to think like I'm going to argue with this guy, and then I thought to myself, I'm like, fuck it, let him be wrong. Who cares?
Yeah,
I know better. So that's it. And I think it's that perspective that you get.
It and like, you know, speaking about that, like the great thing, Ted Kaczynski is going to roll in his grave when I say this, but the great thing about modern warfare is technology. And we, you know, one of those modern technologies is that you can literally fucking record it all. Like,
yeah,
if I wanted to go on to Telegraph right now, I can see what has happened in Ukraine, what has happened in Gaza, what's happening in any sort of war zone in the world. And for the first, what, 2-3 weeks of the special military operation that Russia was putting on, which is going on fucking 2 years, hell yeah, 2 weeks turned into 2 years real quick. Yeah, like when they're the push on Kyiv, or on Kyiv there, like, fuck, it was dudes in buildings with AK-74s and AKMs and whatever, an old rusty crusty kit, just turning fucking BPMs and like, oh yeah, infantry fighting vehicles and all this shit around. Like, it wasn't fucking F-18s with, you know, GBU-31s fucking dropping laser guided, you know, warheads on foreheads. No, it was, yeah, dudes like this, that's my purse, I don't know you, and fucking kicking them out. Like, and that's the one thing, both when we had Quigley on, when he went over with the Canadian Forces for training stuff, and with John, we talked about it before on the show, and I don't know if you've heard the episodes, but there's a duality of Ukrainians. They'll be the first people to kind of, you know, just from the experiences I've heard, is they'll be the first person to give you the shirt off their back, but that shirt that they're giving you, they kind of scammed off someone else. But also, if you are in need, there's no better friend. There's no better people to have around you when you're in need, because they will literally drop everything and get you out of the hole you're in.
It's yeah, we've seen it. So like people on our team, you know, we're using donated vehicles, so they're not always in the best of condition, and you get tires that are just fucked, and you get a flat on the side of the road. And it happened to a couple of our people that were out. They weren't east, but they were in between, and just every single time there's trouble like that, somebody stops, helps them. Hey, my cousin's got a garage in the next town over, brings them there, gets the tire fixed or gets a new tire, brings them back. Like, really, you get looked after if you need help out here. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm Oh my God, excuse me. Try not to belch here.
It's all good, dude. Do it. I'm doing a morning energy drink. You're doing an evening beer. We're allowed to burp.
No, well, I'm on the energy drink shit too. I got this hipster German stuff.
Oh, it's Club Mate.
Yeah, it's actually really awesome.
Googling that.
No, people will help you out here, and it's really, that was something that I noticed. As soon as I came out here, I came back in 2018 as part of the OSCE special monitoring mission. So I was literally monitoring the old ceasefire, the Minsk 1 and 2 agreement ceasefire, and it was strange for me, you know, coming from, especially from like in the Toronto area where everyone's a little unfriendly, to hear where, you know, it's really the opposite. You know, you people, especially you have to say as a foreigner, because it's unusual. And so people here, before when I couldn't speak Ukrainian and I had to use English, or now they'll hear my accent and they'll ask, oh, hey, you know, where are you from? And they're just so interested. But it's also, it's like the honesty and the willingness to help. I have a perfect example. It was, it's back in 2018. My family came to visit, and I'd gone down to Odessa for a weekend with a colleague. And on the way back, I left my camera in like a, what are those things called? Pelican case on the train, and just absentmindedly tucked it under, forgot about it. Was excited to see my family. And so I freaked out, and I had my Ukrainian teacher, I asked her if she could call the station, and I had another friend calling the train company to see if anything had been found. That's not really, that sort of thing isn't going to really be tracked. But what I was told to do, my friend said, just go down to the station when the train's coming in, because it comes in every day, and just ask the people on the train. And I get down there, and here's this dude, you know, the conductor or whatever on the train, he sees me. I had this like Google Translate thing typed out. Hello, yesterday I forgot my camera. And I show him that. He just smiles and he nods. He's like, yeah, I remember you. And then he says, now please get out of the way so people can get off the train. So everyone gets off the car. He invites me back on, and he's got the little, like the little space where they stay during the train ride. And he's got my Pelican case tucked away in his stuff, and he just pulls it out, gives it to me. Everything's there, and it was just, you know, shocking, because I've forgotten stuff on Air Canada flights, and you know, you're coming into Pearson Airport, literally 5 minutes later, you're like, "Hey, this is what I forgot. This is exactly where it is," and it's gone. It's already gone. Yeah. You know, whereas out here, and I, you know, I don't want to sound like an arsehole, but that camera's worth a fair piece. You know, probably. Almost as much as this guy's going to be making in a month. Yeah. And I could do nothing, literally, if he decided that he wanted to sell it. But he didn't, because it wouldn't be the right thing to do. And you see a lot of that in Ukraine. And I think for those of us coming from the West, from like very low trust societies, it's funny because like my wife and my Ukrainian friends, they're always like, you know, you're so not naive, but idealistic about Ukraine. But it really is, you know, if you have like 10% more trust in society, you really notice it. And so, yeah, like, and it's not to say you can't get screwed over, because I've had people try and take advantage of me here, but it's not like I've experienced in other places. And of course, anyone coming over here always has to watch out, because there's any number of little potholes you can sort of fall into, or puddles to step into. But if you know people over here, and if you are genuine in your desire to help Ukraine, the red carpet's rolled out for you. So unfortunately, sometimes undeservedly, because the crowd that comes over here is quite mixed. But overall, my wife and I, we'd already decided to stay here before the invasion. And everything since then has just kind of convinced me that it's the right move. It's like, I love it. I love it. So always sing the praises.
The fact that you've been there, for 6 years, gone through, one of the biggest, invasions that we've seen since 2003. You know, Iraq, U.S. You know, it really says a lot about how you feel about Ukraine, because, you know, I guarantee you there was a lot of Westerners, whether they're in Ukraine for, well, you know, there for civilian based purposes, business, pleasure, whatever, that come February 2 years ago, they're like, I need to get the fuck out yeah. of here, right here, yeah. right now.
There were a lot of people that bailed, but it was, you know, like I'd kind of seen the signs. I'd done my 10 years in the Canadian Army, and I finished up as a sergeant. So I had a fair grasp of like actual sort of strategic stuff and thinking about that. And I'm looking, it was very funny because my logical mind was looking at the numbers that the Russians were putting on the border. And I was like, there's no, like, they can't really believe that they're going to invade with this few soldiers. Like that, they couldn't even take a single city. I mean, like something like Kharkiv, they couldn't take Kharkiv with, at the time it was like 350,000 soldiers, something like that, 450, mm-hmm. don't remember. But then my gut, you know, my instinct is like, yeah, you'd better get ready. And, mm-hmm. you know, like I had, since I came out here, I thought it'd be a pain in the ass to own a car because I didn't know where I would park it living in the city. But I never bought one. But, you know, the month before the invasion, I went out and bought an old Jeep. We packed we packed go bags. We had them in mm-hmm. the Jeep. You know, like I had my plate carrier and other stuff, tucked away in there, ready to go, just in case. And, you know, yeah, it was when we went out so our plan was to go to Lviv, see how things were. And then that was, we could make a determination, like if it really was going to be a steamrolling, you know, I can claim to be a lot of things, but I'm not willing to risk my wife's life. Mm-hmm. So we would get out of there in that situation or see how it developed. And as it turned out, we spent a couple of months in Lviv, working around there, mainly bringing in medical supplies. And then especially once they pushed the Russians out of Kyiv region, it's like, well, why not go home? And so that's what we did. But yeah, seeing the flood of people running out, it was really funny. A lot of even in Lviv, like a lot of foreign students, and they were scared to leave their hotel rooms, so they'd go out and like foraging parties to go to Domino's and get a bunch of pizzas and send one or two from their group, and then they'd go and bring the pizzas back to wherever they were like holed up in a yeah. probably in a pretty nice hotel. It was you know, but there were a lot of foreigners that even stayed in Kyiv and you know, joined up with the local defense units, and when they were distributing the rifles, they were out manning block posts. I don't know how much they're going to do, not speak unless they spoke the local languages. But there's a lot of laughing to do, mm-hmm. but there's also a lot of people that really deserve credit because mm-hmm. they were faced with, you know, they're asked, what would you do in this for what, you know, for most people, especially in the West, is only ever going to be a hypothetical question. And their yeah. answer was, I'm going to stay and fight. And that's, it's awesome. The bravery out here from Ukrainians, from foreigners that have come to help, it's genuinely inspiring. And mm-hmm. it's something that, like, I probably actually, to be honest, I want to get in this in a little more detail later, but it's offered a lot of people the opportunity to get what they were promised by, for example, military service during like the GWAT era, mm-hmm. You know, fight evil. And instead you yeah. get a super ambiguous conflict.
And conflict. Cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. Burn pit cancer and yeah. undiagnosed PTSD. And when you yeah. go, oh yeah, how about this one? When you go to ask for help for it, you know, like,
well, would you like to kill yourself instead?
Exactly. A government agency that won't be named suggests you, take this lethal shot, man. Don't worry about it. Everything goes away. Total peace.
Oh, so cool. Thanks. Two things there. So, you know, the mutual friend of ours that's coming your way soon, you know, one of my good friends, we were talking the other day about the evolution of kit. And so he applied for a certain, you know, to the that unnamed government organization, saying, hey, after almost two decades of military service and multiple tours to, you know, to a place that didn't go so well in the end for a lot of people, my back is completely fucked. And yeah. They're like, prove it. And then, like, so he's like, you know, homie's only he's a shorter dude and I can bench press his weight and I have no upper body strength. Right. But he's carrying around like 100, 120 pound fucking rucks. And like he sent me a photo the other day of his first time in said sandy place and like his kit, like just his fighting load was probably close to 100 pounds. And I'm looking at it like, yeah, there's the fucking issued flak vest. You know, not the plate carrier, the fucking flak vest. And on top of that, he has, you know, the tactical fishing vest, which he put a bunch of pouches on. I'm like, holy fuck. Like, just looking at this makes my lower back and shoulders fucking hurt. Like, he's like, yeah, dude, like my fighting load was probably close to 100 pounds. I'm like, no shit. And then he just messages back. He's like, yep, but back problems are not duty or service related. I'm like,
yeah, not service related.
Yeah.
It's amazing, too. And especially when you, like, I don't want to jump too much into talking about the army because it's you know, whatever, but like,
yeah,
I messed my knee up. I got no cartilage left in my right knee. And I remember I remember the big injury that probably contributed most to that. And it was like, you know, I should probably fill out a form for this. And it's like, yeah. We'll get you the form later. Just we got some other stuff to do.
Just soldier on
over
for
here,
a bit.
Corporal. Yeah. Don't worry. You'll be fine. And then I never did fill out the form. So good luck getting compensated. Whatever. Like I can, there's some good treatments and stuff like that. But at the same time, it is interesting to see, especially in a part of the world where people like to talk so much about the social contract, it's easy to see when you actually really do sign something, how quickly that, you know, is found to not be worth the paper that it's written on.
Okay. Another example. So another homie of mine, he went over to Latvia. He's a reservist, went over to Latvia. I forgot which VP is the non-mechanized VP, but he was, I think, is that 2 VP?
Second, I am the wrong one to ask.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, like I know for like the Princess Patricia's, there's 1st, 2nd, and 3rd battalions, and there's one battalion where it's just like, well, there's 2 battalions where it's like, hey, hop in this lav. And then the one battalion's just like, hey, you got the Shoelace Express to get you there. And he was attached to them. And before he left, like my homie was in the best shape in his life. I think this was like about 2016. He was fucking in shape. And he fucked up his back hard. Like basically slip disc, like bad fuck up in his back. And so he's trying to get back surgery covered by, you know, the organization that says, hey, you know, like you can just sit in this chair and we can make you go to sleep forever. But this is before they were offering that world-renowned treatment. Yeah. But so he's fighting with said organization. They're like, well, how do we know this is like service related? Like, how do we know this didn't happen like before you went off? And he's like, well, if you see here, you made me see a fucking doctor before I bounced, you know, before I hopped in that fucking plane. And that doctor said, you know, this person, good to go. And then when I got back immediately after a week or two, I went to a doctor, the same doctor, and they said, what the fuck happened to your back over there? This person's back. No es bueno. No me gusta. They're like, well, like, how do you know, like, how do we know, like, you know, the doctor just isn't in bed with you? And he's like, because I also saw a fucking back specialist who said, what the fuck? Oh, yeah. And like, he's like, so if you look, there was 6 months where I was exclusively your property and I am now broken of it. And they're like, well, like, how do we know? Like, I remember like he was giving me the lowdown on like as this was all going down. And they're like, well, like there was like a week in between, like where you saw that doctor to where you actually like hopped on the plane and went east. Like, how do we know? Like it didn't like happen in that week. And he's like, because for that entire week, I was just sitting in my bedroom eating saltines and watching YouTube. I don't know how I would fucking shoot a fucking disc out of my back, like, you know, like the way the way you pop a Pez out of a Pez dispenser, like, oh yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, then my grandpa, who did 26 years in the Navy, drunkenly fell down a set of stairs, broke his hip, and they're like, "Free money for life, sir. Thank you for your service." Like, also he was on the HMCS. I think it was the HMCS Athabasca. And there was a fire on it, and he might have breathed in a little bit of asbestos or some shit like that. But they're like, They're like, sir, and like my grandpa, like I miss him every day. And like he was a Navy man through and through. But like, yeah, like he falls down a set of stairs one time after leaving the fucking petty officer's mess on HMCS Tippecanoe, breaks his fucking, breaks his hips in his late 40s, and then breathes in, you know, possibly a little bit of spicy dust. And they're like, sir, here's a blank check every month. Put as many zeros. Do what you want. Where my homie who actually goes over to, you know, where my two homies actually service related who get fucked up. They're like, yeah, we, do you have video evidence of when it happened? Like, yeah.
do you have a notarized transcript of the event?
Yeah. Other than that, welcome to another episode of the Modern Canadian Shooter podcast, where we talk about things that are modern Canadian and shootery. And today we have on Kevin of the Saber Training Advisory Group, who, as if you haven't already figured out from when we were talking before, our previous guest, John Strandhog, went over with these guys. I know someone who's going to go over to Ukraine and do his part with these guys. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on today. And if people haven't already deduced what you do, introduce yourself and your organization to the class.
For sure. Thank you for having me on. So, Saber Training Advisory Group. It's exactly what it says on the tin. We advise with training. So my background, I spent 10 years in the Canadian Army as a reservist out of Toronto, Queen's York Rangers. It's an armored reconnaissance regiment. Now, most of that time I spent dismounted. I would never try and claim to be infantry, but I did do a lot of walking. So I think that qualifies me.
Yeah.
But I came out. Came out here in 2018, initially, as I said before, with the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission. We were overseeing the Minsk Agreement ceasefire. I did that for 4 years up until February 2022. I'm sure everyone knows what happened then. The Minsk Agreements became totally null and void. Russia unleashed their full-scale invasion. For the first few months, I didn't really know what I could do to contribute. I started bringing in medical supplies because that much I knew. I'm like, I know basic TCCC. I know a quality, what a quality tourniquet is. I know what quality hemostatic gauze is. And I know how to use chest seals and what a, quality producer is. So, pardon me, I was bringing in donations from the West and then purchasing these medical supplies. And then having them shipped out here and would run with them out to the East and just kind of find, at this time, I didn't have so many connections with the military. So I would, working through friends, find out people that needed these supplies and just basically show up with these boxes and be like, here you go. Here's 10 grand worth of TCCC supplies. I hope you don't have to use them. Knowing full well that they were going to be used, right?
Yeah. But optimistic, like, oh, fuck, hopefully these collect.
It's like you go to the doctor. I hope we don't see you again.
Yeah.
But, I did that until about August 2022. My wife and I, my wife was able to finally get a visa to come visit Canada. So we went and visited and, met some friends and family that she hadn't met when we got married. And then when we came back, I had started working with a partner. Actually, he's from the, oh my goodness, it's like this part of BC it's near Vancouver, but you have to take a ferry from it because there's no road up to it. It's
Vancouver Island or like the Sunshine Coast?
Sunshine Coast. That's
Sunshine
right.
Coast. Beautiful.
It's an isthmus. Anyway.
Okay.
I think it is isthmus anyhow. Yeah, so his name's Milos, and I started working with Milos, and he comes from a Czech background, hates communists, so
based
this fight here is very personal for him, mm-hmm. And with him, he's a business consultant a project management consultant, really smart guy, knows all this, especially fundraising. He's much better at it than I am, and so I was able to spool off the medical gear. Business, so to speak, to him. And that left me kind of, again, I'm like, okay, well, how am I going to fill my days out here? And I had stayed away from training because, the 4 years that I spent out here, I wasn't keeping sharp. And I thought, I don't know if I'm the best one. I don't know if I should be offering training to people because I haven't kept myself current. And then as I was working more with military guys, I realized like there's a lot of people that they weren't given any they had no option when February 2022 rolled around. They were like, well, I need to get a rifle and I need to fight. And they had carried on fighting from, you know, in some cases from the defense of Kyiv all the way out east, you know, through Kharkiv region, through, you know, into Donbass or down into the south in like Zaporizhia or Kherson. So I realized like, well, no, there are people that need training. I had spent some time looking around at other people that were training, spent a little while working with some others, but unfortunately came to some, you know, we'll say professional disagreements. Mm. And then I had to set out on my own. But when I did, it ended up being actually really good because it let me build what I knew needed to be built. So right from the ground up, when I started Sabre, it was like, okay, we need to have some kind of written curriculum, because if we're not coming from a written curriculum, we can't ensure that we're delivering the same training every single time. And if we're not delivering the same training every single time, we're not exactly fostering interoperability between different forces. And that's a massive, massive problem out here. And you know, we have to be part of the solution. So, it started out literally as, it's actually very funny. I was reminiscing about this last night with another of my instructors and one of our interpreters. It started out with myself, one in like our longest running interpreter, really awesome guy, and another instructor who's also he's also Canadian. He did three years in the army, but then he finished up university. He's British Canadian, so he moved back to Britain, and he was looking to get into the British Army, and he kind of thought, oh, well, why don't I go and you know, spend some time training in Ukraine to, you know, at least have that experience. He's incredibly sharp guy. But it started out with just the three of us in my like busted up old Jeep, driving around, building these connections in the military and saying like, you know, working with units and saying, hey, who can we train? And, you know, we're getting a squad or two of guys for 5 days. And it's like, well, what can we show them? Well, we can show them reacting to contact. We can show them basic fire and movement. We can show them, we'll say the basics of communication, what you should be communicating to one another, you know, radio security, how not to get yourself splashed by painting yourself too loudly on enemy EW. Just kind of, it's stuff that we take for granted in our militaries, because we have pretty long basic training that's quite exhaustive. And you've got a very sharp NCO corps that, you know, having been a sergeant myself, I was always around to swiftly correct people when they did stuff that would get them killed operationally. And so I realized quickly that stuff could be passed on here, because coming from, you know, even before talking about the way the Ukrainian military atrophied in the, say, first two thirds of independence, there was that Soviet tradition.
Yes.
And I mean, that haunts us to this day.
Mm-hmm.
There's no NCOs. Like it's not now. Now there are starting to be people that can be recognized as NCOs. And it's actually super. I love seeing it every time I do. But, you know, you have that the officer will do all the thinking and the sergeants just yell whatever the officer said. And the privates, you know, they don't know their asshole from a hole in the ground. And so anyway, long way of me saying that I saw that there was a niche necessary for training. And as we started picking up momentum, you know, we were working with other reliable people on the ground, building connections that way, getting a little bit of social media exposure, having new people come and volunteer with us. And it really like I saw that what we were doing was viable. And then later on when we were able to sort of find some, you know, say more reliable sponsors, people that could take care of our operational costs for us, that was awesome, because that threw open the door to so many other possibilities, to the point that, without saying too much, we're now negotiating a partnership with an entire branch of the Ukrainian military to come on as an official training partner. And so it's been a wild ride. It's been insane for me, because sometimes I kind of sit back. I won't say that I have imposter syndrome, because I'm generally a pretty confident guy, but I do sit back sometimes and wonder. I look at the other, the other directors in Sabre, two officers, former Marine officer, former British Army officer. And I'm like, I'm just a sergeant, a bloody reserve sergeant. What is going on here? Why am I here? But, and it's like that. I think so many people found themselves in such a situation in this war. And it's like, you're here because you're the one. You stepped up. And especially like when you go to the east of the country and you see the civilian volunteers that bring civilian aid or evacuate people, you know, it's not a bunch of PhDs and staff officers and retired sergeants major. You know, it's regular people who just have we joke about it in our organization, but this, you know, some special brand of autism. Yeah. And yeah, you know, they're just like, I see something wrong that's happening. I know what the right thing is. I'm going to go do the right thing. And like, it's amazing. It really is incredible. But yeah, so that's, I've diverted quite far, I think, from a basic intro, but I did cover all the bases.
We go on a lot of tangents on this show, so don't worry. Like, we recognize that one thought and like let's, if you're into guns or this shit, like, you are on the spectrum. Like, well, pardon me, I'm just, yeah. I don't know if you heard the episode, but like, Taylor and I, we did the RADS R test, which basically lets you loosey goosey know if you might be on the spectrum or not. 65 and above. So it's between, the scale goes up to 250, 250 being like straight up Rain Man. 65 and above is considered most likely being on the spectrum. I'm 64. I was 1 point short. And
oh, man.
Taylor was like 132 or something like that. He's just like, Yeah, no, that tracks.
you gotta send me a link to this. I'm gonna.
Oh, yeah, right now. I'm pulling chat. It up. Yeah, so that's one thing that talking to dudes, talking to people who have either gone over there or know people, like you talked about the atrophy that the Ukrainian military experienced post, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And you look at what the Soviet mentality was when it came to fighting, which was essentially Zerg rush, and eventually we'll fucking, once we use our iron wall of artillery, take out a few of our own units, we'll eventually hit the other group, and whoever's left will go and fucking clean it out. Like it's a practice they've been using since World War II, essentially. And when Ukraine became its own country, post-communist world or post-communist Soviet Union, it really didn't know how to fight its own style of warfare, essentially. Like, every country has its, or, every demographic, say, has its own way of fighting warfare. You know, the U.S. has its way, Canada has its way, France, England, they all have their own ways. China has its way. Ukraine didn't really have its own identity. Where now, obviously being forced both, post Crimean invasion of 2014 and now post 2 weeks special military operation starting in 2022, it didn't really know how to fight. But now you see, organizations like yourself or people similar to yourself, realizing that, and I say this in a good way, and taking advantage of the situation, not in the way of like financially, let's benefit from this, but no, like these guys need to learn how to fight. They need to learn a modern way of fighting. I know how to do this. I have a background in it. I know my homies know how to do this. I've met this community and we know how to do this, and we're able to provide these people some insight onto, to help them find an identity of how, to find their own identity of way of fighting. And it's kind of interesting to see how it's all kind of blossomed out, I guess, in a way is a good way of putting
it.
Because
it's a kind of a cultural renaissance. You're hitting a lot of these notes here. So because I studied history in university, and one of the first things I did when I came out here is I bought this huge book by, he was a York University professor, Subtelny, and it's just Ukraine, a history. Very, very, very short title for a very long book. And one of the kind of red threads, you could say, that runs the entirety of Ukrainian history, and we're going back, you know, this goes back, the book starts with the Christianization of Kyiv, which was like 872 or 827, a very long time ago. But the Ukrainian way has always been, you know, you might call it like Cossack culture, although that term came up after, you know, or much, much later compared to where this mentality came from, where, you know, like we approach, I'll do it by comparison to describe for people. So we approach human rights and individual rights in the West in a very legalistic way. And we're like, well, John Locke wrote down this and John Stuart Mill wrote down that. And according to my nerd legal argument, therefore I have human rights. Whereas it's like vernacular human rights, I guess, out here in Ukraine, where it's just sort of taken, it's not even, of course, now I'm generalizing, but in the day-to-day interactions that you see with people, there's just a basic understanding, what's mine is mine. This is my property. Okay, I'll do with it whatever I want as long as I'm not screwing around with other people. And that's yours. And you even see it, like, it's been interesting because I think in a lot of countries, when there's an existential war on, you're going to see a lot of like, hey, we're taking your gun and we're going to give it to this unit, and we're taking your truck and we're going to give it to that, you know, brigade. You don't see that out here. And that would be hugely antithetical to the way that Ukrainians think. Like they feel themselves very free, and it's not coming from like, you know, that nerd argument like I was alluding to before. It's just an intrinsic understanding. And you see that all throughout Ukrainian history, because you go back, there's in that book that I mentioned, there was a Syrian Christian who was traveling. He's actually coming up from Damascus and then going to, not Damascus. It would have been Constantinople he was coming from. Anyway, I don't hear it there, but he's coming up and he was going to Muscovy. And he wrote during his travels, he said, it's incredible. I'm going through this, what was Ukraine at that time. And I'm in a village, and the villagers, first of all, are literate. They all know how to read and write. The priests feel that it's important to teach them to read and write. That's, you know, wow, what, you know, mind blasted. What's more, all of them, he didn't mention, I'm sure there would be exceptions, but he says, everyone's curious. They want to know where I'm from. They want to know about my journey. They're very open. They'll tell me things. They ask me questions. And then he says, you know, then I crossed over into lands of Muscovy, and it was closed faces and unfriendly. But that openness and that the way that Ukrainians carry themselves as like truly liberated people. And now that was suppressed for like 90 years, longer than 90 years, because the conflict between Muscovy and Ukraine has been going on for about 500 years. But the most destructive period, hands down, was the Soviet period, because there's no, mm-hmm. I mean, when it comes to destroying things and tearing the world up, you know, there's some real whiz bang ideologies out there, but absolutely nothing compares to communism, and mm-hmm. they did everything they could to annihilate that Ukrainian culture, mm-hmm. up to genociding Ukrainians in the Holodomor, and it's funny because. I'm off on another tangent, but you get a lot of people, they go, oh, Holodomor, it was just a bad season. And, you know, there was no intentional genocide. Bullshit. Because while the Holodomor was happening here in Kazakhstan, I forget the name of it, and it's in Kazakh and I don't know that language, but there was a Kazakh Holodomor. And what were the two regions that had the strongest national identity and were most resistant to communism and especially collectivization? Oh, Ukraine and Kazakhstan. And they just happened to starve at the same time. Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah,
so
totally
weird.
Not premeditated.
So weird. Oh.
Yeah.
Weird. How does that happen? Almost, like, dare I say, You know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but communism, big gay?
Huge.
Yeah. They just weren't doing it right. They just weren't doing it right. Real communism? Oh, God. The amount of... It's never been tried. No, we didn't have a terrific example of it for many a decades to which our parents fucking saw firsthand, you know? And we still have people who live through it, who come from those regions and say, yeah, don't. Yeah, no. Hey, they didn't do it wrong.
Real utopia is just a few million human skulls away. Anyway, to come back on the cultural thing, you know, this ties into actually something that comes closer to the shooting aspect of the podcast. You know, you see a lot of that kind of independence and that Cossackdom, you know, like once upon a time, the Cossack would be a guy, he'd have his saber and his pistol and his pipe and his horse. And it'd be like, I think I'm going to ride east today. And he would, and he wouldn't cause any, okay, potentially he would cause some people some problems if he started drinking, but mostly he'd just leave well enough alone. And they know they'd mobilize for war if there was an incursion from the east or an incursion from the west or God knows, sometimes from the south. But the point was, it was born out of the culture here, and it has never left. It was only suppressed. And so when we talk about the cultural renaissance, we're seeing Ukrainians rediscover some of them never lost it, but we're seeing others rediscover Ukrainian history, rediscover the beauty of the Ukrainian language. And I can say a piece on that because I'm not quite, I won't say fluent, but I am conversational. And I talk to people all the time in Ukrainian, and it's an incredibly poetic language, but more on that later. But the point is that it's a rediscovery and a reassertion, a confident reassertion of what is Ukrainian and what isn't, because for the longest time, non-Ukrainian values were imposed here. And it was, you know, just like non-Ukrainian language was, non-Ukrainian religion was, in the case of the Moscow Church versus the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is older. Mm-hmm. Funny thing about that. Everything reminds me of another tangent I want to go off on. I'm a reasonably devout Christian, and I listen to specifically a Catholic, and I listen to people in the West are like, they're banning Christian churches in Ukraine. And then I go and I'm like, you wouldn't really notice on a Sunday. My wife's mother is, you know, like she's in the choir in her church. She's before every holiday, she's waking up at 4 a.m. to go and do practice before the, you know, before the service. And it's like, yeah, banning anyone who's been here for a serious amount of time, and you hear like, oh, they're banning Christianity in Ukraine. Someone tell the Ukrainians, because there's a cross on top of every mountain.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the most God loving, like, it's just one of the most Christian nations when I think about it. Like, fuck.
Outwardly religious everywhere.
Where I live in Kamloops, there's like three Ukrainian, Ukrainian Catholic churches. Like there's more Ukrainian churches here in Kamloops than there is Mormon churches or Catholic churches. Like, yeah, like it's a very popular religion. Like
that is a reflection, like that kind of, we'll say that narrative of closing churches. It is a reflection of the cultural suppression that went on here, because it was just the Russians have strategy that has done very well for them over the decades. It's just lie about it. Oh, you have something coming, something's going on, something that paints you in a bad light. Just lie about it. You know, there's something that you want to achieve, but it requires the suspension of reality. Just lie about it. And, you know, it's frustrating to see that expressed in the West. And especially if we, like, I don't, not to bring any bloody political labels into it, but, you know, like, the direction that a lot of gun owners tend toward in Canada, and the kind of narratives that are actually quite common in that atmosphere, it frustrates me because I got four guns languishing in Canada, and I need to get my license. When I get my permanent residency and I can get my license here, then I can see about shipping them here. I hold a lot of values, and I can relate to a lot of these people in most ways. But then it's like, then they start talking about, and that Zelensky banning churches, and I heard that he owns Burisma, and it's just like, fuck me, man.
Everything's
a
psyop.
It drives me wild.
Everything's a psyop. Everything is a psyop. that's the one thing I've noticed that too. Learning what I've learned over many years now that we see multiple conflict. You know, we have two global conflicts going on right now. We have Ukraine, we have what's going on in Gaza. You see people whip themselves up in a frenzy because they read a certain headline or they read an article on BNN or whatever. But the same people will also joke. I'll see similar people like everything's a psyop, everything's a psyop. But then they'll post something and say, fuck these people. It's just like, dude, like, recognize that we live in everything's a fucking psyop. Obviously there's going to be pro Ukraine, there's going to be pro Russian stuff, and it's learning how to decipher, how to dissect, and actually pull out real information. Like, whenever I see these articles, I don't even read them because I know, wake up, it's a psyop, it's a psyop. They're trying exactly. to fucking change your yeah. And for me, my general mentality is until I actually go over there and view shit with my own eyes and build my own assessment of what's going on, I have nothing to say about it.
Keep agnostic about things until you've got your own data. One of the other tricks too, though, and this is one that really stands out in the Ukraine example, is when you find the most schizophrenic narrative, which is that Ukraine is controlled by the international Jew, but also full of Nazis. Okay, yeah. That's a completely schizophrenic narrative. The top rabbi for Ukraine is in, he was in D.C. and he's advocating relentlessly for Ukraine, 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 Ukraine. And then people are like, oh, yeah, but I heard about the Azov battalion and they all got swastikas on their head. And it's like one of the first officers, the first drone officer in Azov was a rabbi. It's not like no country. There's no country that doesn't have a residue. Can I swear?
Fuck no. Anyway. You're not allowed to fucking swear on this podcast. God, oh, shit. Holy shit. You're not. No, I'm kidding. No, we swear all the time.
No, but so
again,
but no,
tangents and swearing. All we do.
Groovy. No, but there's no country that doesn't have a fucking residue of Nazis and a residue of communists. And I mean, they're all in, they're in their back rooms having their little red, brown and alliance. When you come here and you come onto the ground and you talk to the people, I've talked to people from Azov, I've talked to people from 3rd Assault Battalion, I've talked to, Right Sector people. One of the people that I know who is an instructor for Right Sector is a Jewish guy from Odessa. And it's like, I'm only a history major, but one of the key things I remember about the Nazis is that they were not big fans of Jewish people.
They kind of have a bit of a history of not liking Jewish people there. It's pretty well documented.
They wrote a lot about it or something. It's you get that, you get on that schizophrenic narrative it's the international Jew who has put this democratically elected president in power in order to build the Nazi country that is fighting against the global Antifa. Make it make sense. Make it make sense in totality.
Hey guys, Pat and Taylor from the MCS podcast here, and we want to say a thank you to our new sponsors,
Nuts Off and Gray Fox Strategic, two Canadian-based and ran companies want to help you, the listener, have easier access to their gear.
Taylor and I have both been running Gray Fox Strategic Holstery since before we even met.
And Nutsoff has some terrific scrim and nylon products that the modern Canadian shooter will find very useful.
Want to save some money on a Gray Fox Strategic Holster? Use discount code MCSP10, that's Michael Charlie Sierra Papa 10 at checkout, to save 10% on your order.
And do you want to blend in better with some Nuts Off scrim? Use discount code MCS, Michael Charlie Sierra, at checkout to save 10% on your order.
And we also want to thank Auspec War for jumping aboard as well.
Everybody wants to look cool at the range, but you can't look cool if you're dead.
Check out Auspec War for all of your individual first aid kits, medical supplies, and training needs.
Don't let your worst day be your last day, and get with it.
And we can't forget our longest running sponsor, Misty Mountain Supply.
Use code MCSPODCAST at checkout to save 5% off your drippy syrup order.
We get no financial kickback from you using these codes.
We just want you to have easier access to fantastic gear brought to you by great Canadian companies.
Now, let's get back to the show.
And so that's the thing. It's like the trick is if, you know, it was... Again, I'm trying to avoid politics because I don't want to polarize people.
It's difficult in this day and age. Yeah.
But see, you look to the plague era that we just went through, and we got the schizophrenic narrative of, you know, you are not allowed to gather more than five people in a home, but these special anointed folks are going to have a, you know, gala super duper press junket in any given capital city.
Yeah. With no masks sitting beside each other. You know,
and so schizophrenic narrative. And if it's a schizophrenic narrative, then that's the one that, you know, look, it's trying to be everything to everyone. Mm-hmm. I just wish more, I don't know exactly.
Critical thinking is a skill that's on the decline. Unfortunately, I think it's the best way to say it.
Yeah. No kidding. I remember just an actual brief aside. I remember when I was 21 years old when I started going to university. I'd been 3 years in the army already. And I had thought to myself, I'm like, oh man, all these cool late night conversations I had in the mess where we went really deep and we talked about literature and all this stuff we'd read. I was like, oh, I can't wait to go to university and do that every day. God, bless me.
You were so young and naive.
Oh, was I ever? Was I ever?
Critical thinking, like we talk, like, and like, again, like, you know, kind of what we talked about, like there's been a lot of, God, I hate this word because it's been used by a lot of people that push it, but disinformation, misinformation, all that stuff, there's been a lot of it pushed. And because I remember, right, you know, peak Ukraine, we're talking February, March, 2022. And one of the pages I looked at to get information, which a lot of us gun dudes did, was Forward Observations Group, because... They went to Ukraine back when it was just the Crimean conflict going on. And I remember, so like, you know, they did like an ask, every now and then they do like an ask me anything. And, you know, Raul there on his phone and, you know, answering questions. And I remember someone asked, like, oh, you were with the Azov battalion, like, because like when one of their videos they put out, one of their 3 to 5 minute videos of all the shit they're doing in Ukraine, like, oh, you're with the Azov battalion. Are you a Nazi? And Raul put, like, I remember looking at the, like, it's burned into my memory. He's like, I'm half black and these guys are Nazis. And he's like, if there is Nazis that are part of that group, I personally didn't see any. And I like the way he put that, because he's just, you know, he didn't say, like, I'm telling you what to think. No, there's no this, there's no that. He just said, here's my experience. If there is, I didn't see any. So that's all I can speak on top of that. And people like to shit on Ford Observations Group every now and then because they do have a bit of a hype beast culture. I mean, I bought the $60 t-shirt and the $45 hat. I'm not going to lie. It looks good. They're just the way he presented that information, which is like, I'm not telling you what to think. I'm just telling you my real world experience from what, you know, when me and my homies went over there, this is what we saw. I'm not. And that's all I have to say about that Forrest Gump style.
You know, it's so you can imagine that I've met with a lot of Ukrainian nationalists out here. And what I have found is when there's someone who's not, like, you won't actually see a lot of people that are like, yeah, Nazis are great. what you will see is it's kind of the opposite of what we get in the West of, I know the fucking communists were evil pieces of shit, mm-hmm. and the Nazis fought them, and the Nazis are the opposite of the communists. So that must mean that they're the good guys. Whereas we get taught, I remember when I was growing up, and I was told literally, oh, well, communism is the opposite of Nazism. By what logic? But of mm-hmm. course, you're a child, you're soaking that up, you don't know. And so a lot of people, I think in our generation especially, they were like, oh man, the Nazis were evil and the communists fought them. Mm-hmm. So that must mean it's a syllogism. They're just following simple logic. And I think the people that I've encountered who are not, they're not even pro-Nazi. They're just kind of like not hating on them as much as we would. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, man, like you got to think that syllogism fucked up. And this is where I always use the example, which is that the Ukrainian nationalists, there was one branch of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists. They were happy to work with the Nazis because they thought, okay, we can be a good vassal and they'll let us kind of run our own thing and whatever. And then you had the Bandera faction, which was like, no, only Ukrainian, like Ukrainian self-rule, Ukrainian mm-hmm. independence only. That's mm-hmm. it. And the Abwehr, the German intelligence service, they were like, they wrote a report. They're like, we can't fucking work with this guy. So in 39, when they invaded Poland, he and his organization went into Lviv and they declared a new Ukrainian republic. And the Germans came and arrested him and they put him in a concentration camp. Two of his brothers died in other concentration camps. You get people who are typically people who are aware of the name Bandera go, oh yeah, he was a Nazi. And it's like, okay, his organization, they worked with the Germans fighting Soviets for about a year. And then he was released from the concentration camp. And his very first order to his organization is you will withdraw from your German units. You'll take as much equipment and as many of the guys with you as you can. And you will begin partisan operations against the Germans and the Soviets. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that doesn't, to my mind, doesn't strike me as being particularly Nazi friendly, someone who is in a concentration camp and his first order when he leaves is to begin operations against them. But it was, it is true. Like there were some people who took to Nazism but they're not like, no one's fucking celebrating them here. No one's putting a statue of them up.
Well, we do in Canada. We celebrated one in the House of Commons there.
Well, but that's the thing, right? If I remember correctly, he was from Galicia Division, which was – so it was an SS auxiliary unit. Mm-hmm. But those guys all got investigated. I think it was in the 80s. Someone said, hey, these guys were in the SS. And so a Canadian court was convened and they brought evidence and they said, well – there was the SS and there was the SS because you had SS fighting units. There was this, I forget his name now, but an SS tank ace, who after the war was, he was investigated. He was put on trial. He was found not because he was driving a fucking tank the whole time. He was found not to have participated in the Holocaust. And they said, okay, off you go. And he opened up a pharmacy. And so these guys in Canada were also investigated and found not to have participated in the atrocities. And it was typically because their fighting auxiliary unit being used against the Soviets. Now, there still were others who did participate in war crimes and genocide. But those are not the ones that are celebrated because it's Ukrainians are like the most moderate people I've ever met. It's like, or balanced, I guess is the way to say it, where you'll have like a, like a really, really fervent Ukrainian nationalist. And he's like, but this can be taken too far. It's like, it's kind of like Aquinas, moderation in everything. But that irritated me in Canada because this old guy, they're calling him a Nazi. And it's like, well, he was put on trial. He was investigated. So, are you now, hey, you don't have to believe the courts. And I don't blame people who don't, but it's like, make your mind up either the House of Commons is this place that should never have that sort of thing because it's a very august body, or it's, bankrupt and not worth listening to the earlier judgment, or, you know, the court is as, you know, the one body of the government is as good as the other. Now, I'm assuming a lot there, but anyway, the point being is that they did look into these guys. It wasn't like, I don't, it's like people forgot the post-war period and like, why do we hate Nazis as much as we do? Because we went back and especially in like the 70s and 80s, because actually even like Holocaust scholarship didn't really develop until about the 70s and 80s. Through the 50s and 60s, it was like a niche subject in history. And then, but like once people were exposed to the full horror of it, it's like, whoa, like this is not, you know, hang on a second. Did you guys have anything to do with that? And then it gets looked into. And but that's like, that's that kind of like point scoring. And, you know, I'm not a fan of any bloody party, but there were people jumping on Chrystia Freeland for she was at a rally and there was a scarf with the Ukrainian partisan army colors on it. And they're like, a Nazi organization. I'm like, not if you're aware of history. They spent as much time fighting the Germans, because until the Soviets were able to push back, I guess it was after Stalingrad, and roll back through Ukraine, UPA was not, they weren't really fighting the Soviets. They were fighting the Germans, because that's who was there. That's who was occupying it. And you know, it's not like the Germans were eagerly embracing the Ukrainians. Their plan for Ukraine was bulldoze all the cities, enslave mm-hmm. the population, and put them under some nice, you know, Aryan overlords. And like, it's, I blame it, I think, on in the West, we're very bad at nuanced thinking.
That's what I was going to say.
Black and white.
The context. That's exactly what I was going to say there, is the context. Because we're taught World War II, Allied versus Axis. The, you know, the red, white, and blue, the people that love beavers and the people that have wonky teeth and drink tea versus dudes that bombed Pearl Harbor and fucked over a lot of Eastern Asia and Nazis. And it was a battle of good versus evil.
Don't forget our good friend Joseph Stalin.
Yeah.
And his brave Bolshevik warriors.
Yeah.
It's wild. Cause it's funny. Cause like you go and again, if you get serious about history and you see how fractious everything was mm-hmm. and how the Western allies and the Eastern ally were at odds with one another constantly.
What happened right after World War II? Like, mm-hmm. perfect example.
Through the 30s and then 45 and onward. And even another one, which a lot of people probably aren't aware of, and I'm only beginning to learn about myself, is how fascist Italy, how much fascist Italy tried to undermine Nazi Germany in the 30s, because they were like, they're looking across Austria like, ugh.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we look like Lebensraum.
Yeah.
But you know, it's nuance, and it's like not everything is like, there are some things that are definitely a question of good and evil, and it's a very mm-hmm. simple thing. But not everything is like that. Not everything is a Marvel movie or Star Wars. You know, there are shades of gray, and you can still like, you can absolutely criticize the moral grounds of certain things that turned out to be, you know, for the good. Mm-hmm. But you can also look at the goods, the side that was absolutely morally good, and say, hey, do you really think that you should have fucking done that? Like Japanese internment in Canada, there were families who had World War I veterans who were decorated, mm-hmm. Japanese Canadians, who got all of their shit taken from them. And yep. and thrown into now they weren't thrown into annihilation camps. That's a very important difference. But still, they had their property
taken
from them. In prison
for 5-6 years.
That's it. Yeah. My dad's grandfather, he actually he's a, so that branch of the family's out from BC, and he was lauded in his area by the Japanese Canadians, because he was like a Quaker or something, but he was ultra devout, and to the point that he wouldn't deposit money in banks because the, you know, 2% the 2% that they gave you was usury. And he's like, no, I'm not doing that. But he went and as they were interning the Japanese in the area, the other farmers, he went and he said, I'm going to buy your land from you. We're going to sign a contract. When you are released, I'm going to sell it back to you for exactly what I bought it for. And he did that for several families in order to prevent them having their livelihood taken from them. And, wow. And like, that's, we can look at that and we can look at our own problems and we don't have to light ourselves on fire for it. And we don't have to say, like, you know, you don't have to do a Japanese Canadian land acknowledgement, but you can criticize that. And then you can look at the, oh man, it's that, you know, the Sabaton song about Castle Itter. It was the VIP prison, where anyway, German army, they were getting ready to surrender because they're like, they're defending this prison for VIPs in a castle somewhere. The Americans reach them, or some like company or whatever reaches them. They're like, hey, yeah, we're going to surrender. No worries. Then the Germans found out that an SS unit was coming to liquidate that prison.
Oh yeah, I've heard this story. Yeah.
Well, you know, these Germans, while the war was ongoing, defended the castle alongside the Americans to prevent the liquidation of that castle, liquidation of the prison population. And like, these are stories worth telling, because every person's an individual, and there are heroes everywhere and there are villains everywhere, even on the villains on the good side, and there's heroes on the bad side. And if we only ever make, you know, everyone against me is fucking Darth Vader, and everyone who's on my side is Captain America, and totally morally unimpeachable. We gloss over so much good and so much evil. And that's something that has, I think, has contributed to a lot of our modern problems, in the West, I mean. And it has consequences out here, because if you can't apply nuanced thought on something that you're intimately familiar with in your own society, how are you going to do it for an issue that's happening halfway around the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it ties into what I said before. Yeah. Nuanced thinking, you know, which ties into critical thinking. It's a skill that isn't being taught anymore. The one thing, like, you know, when you're talking about, like, you know, how we learn history here in, you know, the Western world, you know, especially back to World War II. I remember when we were learning about World War II back, and I think it was grade 10, grade 11, and it was the best time I ever did in history, like all A pluses for a bit. But like, I remember our history teacher, and I'm glad he talked about this, because like, yeah, he's like, yeah, it was us and the communists versus the Nazis. But then he said, like, but also, let's take a look at who our ally was for that. Let's take a look at what had been going on in Russia for a little bit before, and how they did everything. And that right there, I'm just like, oh yeah, okay. Because like, all I ever knew about Russia at that point was watching, you know, Enemy at the Gates, and you know, kind of, you know, that's about it. And then like, he showed that. He showed that the nuances of who our friends were. And like, yeah, actually, my history teacher in high school was, you could tell he didn't go off the curriculum that was presented in front of him. Like, he was one of the dudes who taught critical thinking. Like, you need to know, history isn't just a story of good and evil. History is stories, and stories have different backgrounds. And yeah, like he showed us a bunch of shit. And I'm really glad for that. Like, I won't say his name. I should go find him back in Vancouver and just say, thank you for making, you know, for help. Thank you for helping me see through the PSYOP. No. But yeah, just like little stuff like that, because it's just what we've been taught through many years. It's just the curriculum. The curriculum's a PSYOP as well. But just, yeah, it's always good versus evil. Well, no, fuck, it's stories. And like you said, people are individuals. Individuals have their own will, have their own wants, and that, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but it all tells a story.
That's it, man. It's humanity and it's full form. And that covers everything. That covers, you know, Mother Teresa all the way to literally Hitler.
Yeah. But to Gandhi. My favorite people, like, Gandhi, you're such a good human being. It's just like, look a little more into that. He was
such a human being.
He's such a human being. Let me just tell you, do not look into his racist past. Whatever you do, do not look into his incredibly racist past.
Don't be Muslim around him. No,
yeah,
it's
skin pigmentation darker than him. Yeah.
Ooh, wrong cast.
Yeah.
Did you just look me in the eye? It's weird, and it is a, and actually, I think too, it's also kind of like a North American thing because we don't,
for sure,
we don't get out much.
We don't,
and you know, it bothers me how I work with a lot of Americans now, as I think you can imagine, and it used to bother me, but it bothers me more now when I hear like Canadians like crapping all over Americans, and it's like, come on, man, that we're literally on the same in the same boat, so to speak, on the same continent. And we have so much in common. And again, like if you think because you're born in Canada, oh, I'm just so much more worldly, you know, most Americans don't even have passports. It's like, buddy, where have you gone with yours? Fucking Cuba? Congratulations. You're giving money to commies. But, you know, I remember because I used to get the whole like, you know, everyone admires Canada. Everyone loves Canada. Everyone's thinking about Canada all the time. And I got out here and I'm meeting all these people from all over the world. And I'm like, yeah, I'm from Canada. They're like, oh yeah, cool. Yeah. My cousin went to
Toronto.
Edmonton.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. You know, once I traveled around a bit, it put the lie to a lot of things. Like,
Yeah, dude.
You know, Oh, yeah. The TTC. Why does the TTC suck so much? No, the TTC is great. It's amazing. It's wonderful service. You shouldn't expect better. And then I go to, I ride the public transit in Vienna is like the prime example, but here in Kiev, I ride the public transit. I'm like, wow, it's clean. No one's yelled at me. Nothing smells.
I haven't been stabbed.
Yeah. Not even once, not even a little.
Yeah.
And there's, oh, by the way, full cell signal, 4G in like underground, 100 meters underground. It's wild. I love it. But you know, it gets me because it is, there's, and I think it's a North American problem because we have basically three, well, not basically, we have three countries
three
that make
countries.
Up an entire continent and we have wide, not monocultures in each, country, but broadly the same. You're not going to have as much cultural diversity, even between Ontario and BC, as you would between Slovakia and the Czech Republic, which were one country for a long time.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I talk to friends a lot. You know, like I did honeymooned in Europe. And you know, where we traveled was the equivalence of us going from like, you know, in our entire honeymoon would be us from going to like Vancouver to Fort St. John to Jasper and back. Like we did Scotland, Ireland, Spain. And you look at it like, it's not a lot of Europe, but we learned a little bit. But like, just in Canada alone, like British Columbia, if it was in Europe, would be three to four different countries easily.
Yep.
But you would have a lot different cultures in each one. Like the culture in Ireland was completely different than the culture in Scotland. Well, not completely, but there was a lot of huge different nuances. Yada yada yada. Like there was big differences. All I knew that both places it was good to rip on the English, which I do anyways. So we got along great there. But the one thing you talked about too is the Canadian culture, and we've touched on it a few times in this show. What is the Canadian culture? And it always burns down to one thing. Well, at least we're not American. And I've called friends and family out on them. Like, what the fuck's wrong with that? They're like, well, look how pompous and arrogant they are. I'm like, I've had Americans pay my mortgage. You know, through like, you know, some of the content stuff I do, like, like if you're again, it's like, why are you hating them? They're great people. What great friends and allies we have to the south. And my favorite thing I always do too is whenever I get, you know, on the gun groups and stuff like that, because I love America. Like if I could, I'd be living there right now. But whenever Americans rip on me for being Canadian, I always drop this on them and it silences them. To which I always say, well, at least my country didn't get beat by a bunch of wonky tea-sipping inbreds that fucking simp for a queen. Wrong side won in 1812. You guys should have tried harder. And they go like, yeah. Like, you could have had 20 more states. And they go like, yeah, fuck, you're right. And I actually had a good buddy of mine. He went down to the U.S. and he dropped that line on them. They're like, fuck, you're right. God damn it. We did try hard enough.
Yeah. You guys gave up.
You guys gave up. You guys were fucking batting 100 at that point, and you got punked by some fucking punks. Canadian culture too. When you break it down,
too. It's not much different from American. The only difference is it's harder to get old nicotine pouches, and we don't have a lot of but you know, getting different interesting flavors of Mountain Dew is a lot more difficult. But yeah, like people rip on on American culture, and it's just like, my brother in Christ, break down your culture. It is the Coke Zero version of it. Like, we are a direct offset.
Man, imagine being not quite from Toronto, but I grew up 55 kilometers north of Toronto. So I spent a lot of time in Toronto, and it's just, it's like trying, and it kills me actually, because say back in like up to about 2012, I really loved Toronto because there was all kinds of like quirky niche stuff and really like, just, I remember during my basic training, it was like summer of 2009, and we had a long weekend, and I thought, let's go down. We'll get a room at a hostel, some cheap in Toronto, and just go do whatever the hell we want. And it was in Kensington Market, which at that time was like mega hipster land, like not before the term hipster existed. Like this was just like, you didn't finance workers and advertising people did not go there. Mm-hmm. And we're in this hostel, and then in the basement of the building the hostel's in, there's like a goth bar playing, you know, Sisters of Mercy, The Mission, Damnation. There's another one that I've forgotten, but there's probably a goth band called Damnation. But anyhow, wild music like I had never heard before. And this is before Shazam, so I had to sit there and memorize pieces of lyrics and then type it out and Google. And it was so cool because there was actually neat stuff, and like each part of the city had its own feeling. And then it just started, you know, I say 2012, but I don't know, maybe it was before, maybe it was a little after, but it just started to kind of, everything started to homogenize. Everything started to be catered towards the sort of laptop workers, from the financial area of the city. Toronto lost its way, and then it started basically trying to be, you know, fake New York.
Yes.
And you know, anyone who's been to real New York, I got a lot of friends who are, you know, New Yorkers, and Toronto does not, it doesn't compare. It's not even like a borough of New York. And, you know, why give up a unique thing that you had in order to be
Coke Zero New York.
Coke Zero, Coke Zero New York. Fuck it.
Yeah.
But so it's frustrating. But well, no, anyway, freaking there was something that I really wanted to get into. And I don't mind me being a little bullish here, but I got to make sure that I mention it.
Yes. Because
I promised to talk about civilian gun culture here.
That's what I was going to ask! That's what I was just about to ask!
Great minds, man.
Autistic
great
high minds. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
Civilian gun culture in Ukraine. What was it like before? What's it like now?
Oh, man. So my neighbor, I had a very lucky to have a nice apartment. And I lived in back when I was with the OSCE, and I didn't want to change. My neighbor just down the way, in the hallway here, he owns like the best tactical shop called Abrams in Kyiv. Mm-hmm. And so he's really plugged into all this stuff, as you can imagine. So we're shooting the shit. And, you know, his wife speaks a little bit of English. Back then I spoke much less. This is like when I first got here, obviously I spoke much less Ukrainian, but I was muddling through, and they'd invited me over and actually invited all the neighbors over, I think. Anyhow, he asked me if we can have guns in Canada. I said, you know, it's really restricted, but here I started showing him the, you know, the photos I had on my phone, and he's like, oh, do you want to see my guns? And fuck yeah.
Please.
So he comes out and he's got an AKM that's like totally, it's like all kinds of Magpul furniture. It's really nice. And a big fat 72 round drum magazine on it. And I looked at it. I'm like, Yelihomo? Like, that's legal? He's like, yeah, I think there's some magazine limits, but it's kind of like nebulous. A lot of stuff is just unregulated here, and it's just kind of like, I guess if it's not specifically illegal, then it must be legal, which duh. But yeah, so he's, you know, he's got that drum mag, and I started talking to him, and then I went to some ranges, And so before it was obviously much more niche before. Now it's suddenly has very wide appeal, we'll say, gun ownership. Mm-hmm. But it was really cool because everyone was kind of into military shooting before, and you'd go and you'd look at the, I can only window shop. But I would look at the gun stores and it's lots of AKMs, all semi-auto. But like lots of really high end ARs, tons of Daniel Defense out here. The markup's really huge, which I don't think I'm ever going to be able to buy here, but, I just need to get my AR from Canada.
Yeah.
Once the invasion began, huge emphasis was thrown on civilian ownership because a lot of the people that fought in the defense of Kyiv, when my wife and I, when we were making our drive west, the block posts out there were typically not manned by military personnel, be manned by veterans, you know, maybe a local guy with a shotgun and someone who's got a semi-auto rifle, and they're just checking, you know, and it's funny too, because it's like, you know, everyone has these fever dreams of like, oh my God, they're going to be totally, totally goose-stepping Nazi people and really authoritarian at the block post because it's not the government manning it on this. This is in the first week. So just to make that clear. And it's like, no, it's just people that they look at the ID, they see it's a foreign ID. Oh, I love Canada. And then I speak a little bit of Ukrainian and they're like, you speak Ukrainian? Oh, that's awesome. Come on through. To come back to the civilian gun ownership, because, you know, in the Kyiv region, a lot of the people that were, you had that giant Russian logjam convoy north of the city. And it was basically just kind of like a partisan buffet, ride up on a quad, shoot a rocket at a fuel truck right away. And I know people who did literally that, and they were doing that now. Okay, this isn't the two-way wet dream of the completely legal civilian rocket propelled grenade launcher. But that would be the only thing that they'd have from the government. Everything else was their own. Mm-hmm. And so now our organization is we've done a couple little meet and greets. I brought some of – I went myself to one weekend. And then I brought last weekend I'm counting in my head – five of my instructors and one of our interpreters to work with a civilian training organization here. It's called Backyard Camp, and they've got Ukrainian instructors. They've got some foreign instructors. And the whole point is to, the owner of the organization is, I really like the guy. Like the first time we met, he was introduced to me by a friend of mine who's a veteran out here. And a civilian gun owner, really, 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 really switched on guys. He did a lot of hard fighting in the defense of Kyiv and later in the east and south. Anyhow, he introduced us and I'm talking with this guy and he's saying, you know, I want to build up the gun culture in Ukraine. And I want people not to think of it as like just a throwaway hobby, but as like partisans, as part of the defense of Ukraine or the system of defense of Ukraine. And that's like right up my alley, because when I was a reservist, I believed that I should have my own rifle. I should have my own armor. I should be able to step out of my house and be able to literally go and meet my guys and not have to go to some armory. Like
be an asset, in the not case a liability. Of,
exactly. Like I mean, in that case, like if Canada was invaded or something, like I can't just go to the armory because the armory's going to be a crater.
Yeah.
Which was funny because there was some stuff that I remember I said, it was a room full of other sergeants. And I said, guys, I think it's worthwhile if we were actually, you know, looking at how small the Canadian Army is, how much land there is in Canada, I think it'd be worthwhile for us to study asymmetric fighting the way that our adversaries in Afghanistan do it. And I got laughed at. And I come here to my real life conventional war experience and I'm like, wow, actually that theory is completely borne out. And so that's what Backyard Camp is all about, is basically building up a core of partisans who can defend Ukrainian territory, defend their home territory, and to demystify the profession of arms for regular people, so that, you know, maybe volunteering for the military or the prospect of being conscripted isn't that scary because you know the basics. And, you know, what's really cool is if you extend that out, you get guys who get really well trained up is they have the potential when, you know, when and if they are conscripted or when they volunteer, they have seen so much good instruction that they are able to act as instructors themselves and spread that knowledge and potentially save lives because they're, you know, it's getting much better. But in the first year, there was just everything was an emergency situation. And, you know, we would get maybe 5 days with the people that we were able to train. And, you know, you can have the best instructors in the world. It's just not enough time to take 10 years of knowledge and put that out. Even just doing basic stuff, like it's really, really short.
Yeah.
And so spreading that knowledge out through the civilian community is absolutely amazing. And you're seeing a lot of that. And there's like, you know, you go to like military surplus stores out here, and it's the Ukrainian guys always smile when I say this, but you would see this patch and it says, "Вільні люди мають зброї," free people have weapons. And, you know, like it's incredible. And what's also nice is Ukraine offers this amazing case for the people that like to talk about, like, well, we need to ban guns for the safety of society. So I didn't know them personally, but I was only ever a few links in the chain away if I wanted to buy an illegal machine gun. We're talking, you know, full caliber machine gun back before the invasion. That was not available. There was a group that got busted. It's like one of the militias that are fighting now against the Russians. They got busted. They had a BTR. They had an armored vehicle in a garage somewhere, rockets and mortars and stuff. There was a guy, he was a veteran suffering from PTSD. He had a grenade and he held a bus hostage, but then he was persuaded to let the passengers go. And then eventually the tactical police came and they talked to him. He let the driver go. He surrendered peacefully. But I bring this up because, you know, you have an ongoing conflict, very big one, even before the full-scale invasion. And there was tons of illegal weapons or tons of access to illegal weapons, but you didn't have mass shootings. Murders were far more rare. They're still far more rare here in Kyiv than they are in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And so it blows up that bullshit public. I mean, we know it's bullshit, but
yeah,
it truly annihilates that argument because when we go out east to train people, I've had soldiers that they're happy to have the training that we offer. And they're like, oh, here's a grenade. I've got a photo of it. I was by one group we were working with, the 4th Rapid Reaction Brigade of the National Guard. Four or five different guys came up and gave me grenades. And I had one of those like old Soviet impact grenades. I had a couple, like a modern Bulgarian version of an old Soviet grenade. I had an M67 and I had that German splitter grenade with the shrapnel sleeve. And you know, I didn't take this stuff with me, because I don't believe it's not ethical to be like the grenade that those guys might need. I can't take it with me. B, it's illegal. And I'm going to go through checkpoints and they're going to say, do you have any weapons in the vehicle? And, you know, whatever I say, I may be searched. So I'm not going to play that freaking game because I'm trying to be a good immigrant here. But the you know, if access was the issue, where is the massive wave of crime here?
Yeah, it's exactly. And Canada has shown the opposite. I mean, like, you probably know what's like, you know, handguns are now essentially the sale and transfer of handguns is banned. ARs have been banned for we're going on 4 years now. And yet we've had an uptick of people getting their gun licenses here in Canada, with less access to weapons of war that were designed to kill as many people in the shortest amount of time. And you look at the crime has gone up, yet access has been limited severely. So it proves, like it's an understanding of socioeconomic repercussions of what's going on right now. And the other thing I attribute a lot to it is the collapse of the family unit that's been going on for the past 20 or 30 years. That's a big one. And the other thing, this is my favorite thing though, and I very rarely look at Twitter on my phone. I only do it And then you go. My favorite thing is like everything that shows up on my Twitter feed is anti-gun stuff and stuff from the left side of the aisle. When it comes to politics in Canada, and my favorite is whenever you see people posting anti-gun tweets, and they'll be like, "Yeah, nobody needs this," blah blah blah, and then you see a Ukrainian flag in their bio, and it's just like, and I've asked someone, I'm like, "So you don't believe like people civilians should have access to firearms to weapons?" They go, "Not at all." It's like, "So like what's with that like Ukrainian flag in your bio then?" Because fucking happened on the lead up to. To the lead up from like, you know, December, January, right until, what was it, February 13th or whenever the invasion kicked off, Ukraine was literally going into their stores and just going like, "Do you have two hands? Do you have at least one eye? Congratulations. Here's a brand new AK-74M. Just wipe the grease off."
Kharkiv. I remember it was a news article in like the media out here. Kharkiv sold out. The gun stores were completely sold out. Every single round of ammunition that they had emptied out. And it's funny because that's like the Russian speaking capital in the east or whatever. And that's another fucking thing that gets on my nerves when I hear about Russian speaking. I only speak Ukrainian. When I go out to the east of Ukraine, I still only speak Ukrainian. I don't understand Russian. I understand it okay-ish, but I don't speak it because I don't know it. And guess what? People there, they're not Russian speaking. They're bilingual, Ukrainian and Russian. And some families, because for 90 odd years, it was advantageous to speak Russian everywhere you went, because that, you know, if you went, you were a dumbass villager if you spoke Ukrainian, and you would never get a good job. But guess what? You know, I go into the, I remember it was a dentist we stayed with one trip when I went out to Kharkiv, and in his house. So first of all, out in the street, mostly he's speaking Russian, but we went back and we were talking with him and his dad, possibly having some adult beverages. And it was such a thrill that I spoke Ukrainian, and they immediately switched into Ukrainian. And they had, you know, they had a portrait of Nestor Makhno, who was a not quite an anti-communist, but an anarchist. Like, actually, he believed what Lenin was saying before Lenin had power. But he's a hero in mostly in the east and south of Ukraine, because he just basically said, "Oh, you like authoritarianism? Fuck you. Here's a machine gun. The business end of a machine gun." You know, it's like I got other one of our other former instructors. He's got friends who are all refugees from Donetsk. They all fled because they believe strongly they know they're Ukrainian. And you know, it was very funny. We were in a little get together, and they were mostly speaking Russian. And I came in, and I don't remember exactly how it came up, but another of the people there said he was learning Russian, and he's like, they turned to him. They spoke English as well. And they said, "Why are you learning Russian?" He says, "Oh, well, I live in Kharkiv," and I kind of razzed him. I'm like, "Man, like every time I go to Kharkiv, I only speak Ukrainian, and you get by just fine." The whole group, all of them from one of the easternmost cities in Ukraine, they all immediately switched into Ukrainian because they heard me speaking it. And it was just, it's just a bugaboo that gets me when I hear about Russian, the ethnically Russian Ukrainians or Russian speaking Ukrainians, as if that justifies what Russia's doing, because that comes up a lot. But to come back on the gun ownership, you know, what we did, it was actually yesterday when I was out there with my instructors at Backyard, and we had some of their more experienced students, and their weapons handling all on point. Every single one of them understands that they're using different sites and they're using different manufacturers. Everybody understands his weapon. We had a failure to extract on a fired round. So it was a giant pain in the ass because the brass had expanded. And you know, we waited to see if it was a hang fire. It wasn't. they had dental picks there. So the guy who owned it, he just went, got the dental picks, cleared that brass. And then we carried on. And these, you know, like, again, like you, people are kind of like, everything is a little thrown together, certainly nothing standardized, but, and it's a big thing that Backyard, puts emphasis on, is like, you need to know your kit. You need to know why you have the things you do, mm-hmm. you know, how to use them. What, you know, what is a dump pouch for? Like someone had asked me earlier, he's like, do you think it's better for me to have a dump pouch, you know, in the middle of my back or more towards, you know, one side or the other? And I said, I was like, man, like it's a lot of it's going to come down to how comfortable you are. Now I wouldn't recommend putting it on the side of your dominant hand, because that's not what's going to be dealing with your magazines. But like they're actually thinking, and it takes me back to, like, I remember when I started getting into the civilian side of shooting, probably would be about like 2009, 2010, like when I was I was a soldier, but I was becoming a proper soldier, mm-hmm. learning more and getting experienced and like asking myself questions about the equipment I was using. Like, it really sucks having my mags up here. Why do we do that? Because the vest was designed by a staff officer. You know, like, why don't we, it's actually funny. I had a fun evolution where I was like all about plate carriers. No, you know, it's so stupid to have your armor separate from your ammunition, da, 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 da. Back around to spending a lot of time driving, out east here, driving with my armor on. Cause when we're teaching in the east, like we're like 13 kilometers from the fucking Russians. So mm-hmm. fuck yeah, I got my armor on because artillery sucks. But well, being on the business end of
receiving
it,
receiving end, yeah, sucks. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, so like, I'm getting in and out of my car, and I got my double stack mag pouches, super awesome assaulter man. You know, my storage crap on the side, and I'm just like, this fucking sucks. And that's, I'm like, you know what, load bearing vest, slick plate carrier. Why the hell not? I can tuck an IFAC in the side of the plate carrier and then just have my LBV, like when I get in a car, I just put it in the back seat. Mm-hmm. And like, yes, maybe if I have to ditch out of the car, it's gonna take me extra time to get my stuff. But that said, I'm not armed anyway, so who fucking cares? My actions on ambush are fucking run.
Yeah. That's something I've learned just as a civilian shooter. Like, I played airsoft many, 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 many years before a shooting. And then, you know, now with me doing training, you know, with training groups and stuff like that, me doing brutality events, everyone always thought that there's like there's the end all be all perfectly flexible kit for fucking everything. Like, I have this one plate carrier and I can do everything with it. And I've learned over time, no, like that doesn't really exist. I've created different kits. Like last weekend, down in Vancouver, I'm running my Type 81, doing stuff with a shooting group. And I thought, like, in all these pouches, it says it can take AK style mags. I'm like, all right, like let's fucking find this out. Let's find this out. Yeah. Let's call it. And no, it fucking sucked. It absolutely fucking sucked. And so like after that, I walked away. I'm like, okay, no, like this plate carrier is only for Stain-Ag mags. It's only for 223.556. What I can do is, yeah, get like a chest rig or something like that, swift clip it on, and then make it adaptable. But you know, and that's the other thing, like with one, you know, with Veritac, when I was doing stuff with, when I was training under those guys, and everything that they do is under the close protection, you know, style of kit. So then like we're doing practice drills with the vehicle, but there's no shooting and stuff like that. But like, all right, get in this vehicle, get out of this vehicle with the kit you have. And I'm wearing my fucking plate carrier and my battle belt, or like, you know, my first line. And like, I've got an IFAC on the back of my first line. And it's like sitting in this fucking car sucks right now. Like, I'm 6'3" and having that belt push my ass out fucking another 3 inches. Like, this fucking sucks. And it's just, yeah, learning, like, and, you know, talking to one of my homies, and we're talking about like how we have our kit set up and stuff like that. And like, where should I put this? You know, you have context. And they're like, well, again, and it's something I've started whenever people ask questions on like Facebook or Reddit and stuff like that. Where should I put this? Well, what's the context? Mm-hmm. And then once you realize the context, like now my plate carrier, it's made more for like a brutality event. It's slicker. It's more low profile. So if I have to climb over a wall or crawl under something, it's not a hassle. But if I'm having to fucking, you know, go ruck and do a 10 kilometer patrol
or some shit like that. If there was a situation like that, like, fuck no, I wouldn't be using that because all it has on it is ammo and an IFAC, whereas some other, like, it has nothing for sustainment gear. It's just learning.
Yep.
What's the context of what you're going to be using it in, and then make and then adjusting it so that it better fits that context, kind of deal.
That's it. It's a big thing. You know, the tools you need to use the right tools for the job, and that goes into like that's like fractal levels of complexity. Like, how deep do you want to go? Yeah. And that's the cool, you know, the cool thing is that the situation here has brought that into such sharp focus that you know, people are really thinking about it now. And the, you know, we talked about it before about Jean and his adventures with Sergeant Major. And, you know, I laugh because I think about the stuff that quote unquote leadership that I saw in the Army, invested time and energy into. And I see here in like a, you know, a serious existential conventional war. And it's like, oh man, oh boy, you know, hey, are you troops polishing your boots in the field? Because, you know, appearance is a cornerstone of professionalism. And it's like,
Because you want to have something glistening on your body. Things naturally shine in nature. Yeah.
It's like that. Cause now, There's stuff to be said about discipline. And if you didn't, like, listen, even if you're, I'll tell you right now, like I keep clean shaven. I prefer to be that way because when I grow a beard, my face gets itchy as shit. But the thing is like there is value in enforcing certain things that are inane in and of themselves, but speak to professionalism. Like I remember it's funny. It's one of the last courses I taught. I was stopping the formation and just ballsing them out because they kept getting out of step. And some of these troops, it's sharper guys. And so they knew they weren't the problem, but they come over to me. Well, they knew they weren't the problem. They come over to me and they're like sheepishly, well, Sergeant, you know, we were kind of thinking like maybe we weren't the problem. And I was like, all right, boys, hold my watch. Look at the second counter on the watch. I'm just going to call drill for myself. I marched in a little square, perfect half second steps, took my watch back. And I said, I'm not the problem. And cause it's like, yeah, that stuff is inane, but you get good at it out of spite almost. Mm-hmm. And like some of that stuff really goes to discipline. However, if you put too much of an emphasis on it, if you take training time away from privates that should be learning their fundamental skills, and you say, no, I'm going to make you fuckers do drill until you die. You know what? Let your drill perfect your drill on fucking PLQ. Cause God knows you're going to do enough of it. Mm-hmm. The time that you spend between, what do they call it now? JLC? I don't know. Anyway, but the leadership course.
Yeah.
But the time that you spend, especially as a private and a corporal, you should be learning to kill and destroy. Mm-hmm. And man, fuck, parades are a fucking joke. So don't worry about it. Out here, most soldiers don't even get issued dress uniforms, even before the invasion, because it's like, what's the fucking point?
We're
going to have these guys go on parade. They're all handsome, big chests. Those are the guys we're going to put on parade. Everyone else, worry about fighting.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's that practicality. Ukrainians are very practical people, and that goes everywhere. And it goes into the civilian gun training. And it's really like, it's really sweet because, you know, I talked about it before, but you know, about that cultural renaissance, and that goes into the training as well, because the independent, like this independent mindedness of Ukrainians suits itself perfectly to mission command. And when we were training a lot of platoon commanders earlier in the year, in summer of 23, I forgot it's 24 now.
Yeah.
we were teaching these guys and they were a little skeptical at the beginning because some of them have dealt with other Westerners. Some of them have dealt with the NATO training that has unfortunately failed to adjust to the situation.
Real world. Yeah.
It's not bad. It's just like there's some things that are only ever going to be achieved by getting the training here in Ukraine. Mm. Anyhow, we're working with these young platoon commanders, officers in their 20s and early 30s in some cases, and watching them when we bring them through the planning process, and we're teaching them about how to structure orders and how to think about a mission. We're making them do map models and like, here's your objective. You need to explain this to your guys. And watching it click with these platoon commanders and squad leaders and platoon sergeants, you know, it was beautiful. And they really get it, and they'll surprise you. I love it. We very early on, we were training some guys. They were more like partisans in the north of Kyiv, and they wanted to. Their whole thing was like local defense. So they're in a reasonably built up area. So we're doing a lot of Fibua and a little bit of CQB. We Sabre has never been a CQB fetishist organization. Never will be.
Wait, so you guys don't train footwork?
Footwork.
Footwork. What are you? Look at your footwork. What is your footwork? Yeah, fuck.
I'll have a thing on that, but it's not for the podcast. Footwork. Oh boy, I hate that word. Anyway, so we had an objective as an abandoned building, and we gave the guys, they were in a forested area down the road, and their idea was to approach tactically, and then I told the instructors, I said, if they're fucking lazy and you see them, you engage them 200 meters away, make them fucking work for it. And the only thing we saw of them on the approach was like a couple guys moving between some buildings very far away. And it was we only saw one or two dudes. And they were like, well, should we engage? And I'm like, there's nothing really to engage. Like just let them run it. And so I was getting increasingly excited because I'm like, they're not doing what I thought they were going to do. What are they doing? How are they going to approach? We didn't become aware of them until they started breaching the building, and we hear them yelling. We hear, you know, little like practice, like airsoft grenade go off. And we're like, what the fuck? And we look down and they, you know, the last of their guys were coming inside of the building, and it's like, oh shit. So what they had done is these guys had gone, there's like a hill up to the, say, to the north of the building or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they had gone around, instead of coming directly to the building, they had gone around up to the top of that hill. They stopped a bus and they said to the driver, hey, we're doing some training. Let us in the bus. Just drive us to the bottom of this hill and we're all going to get out, you know, near this building. So we'd seen the bus. We didn't see them getting on, but we had seen the bus, and then we just thought, bus, da-da-da-da-da. And then that's how they snuck up on us. Now, you know, would that work in the real world? Maybe not, but at least it was something, it was creativity, and it was creativity. Yeah, it was them surprising us. And so I was really, you know, in that moment, I was very happy to see them kind of like not waiting to be told what to do, not trying to do things in the exact same way that we had practiced, but like trying to think outside the box. And that's huge out here. And it's very funny because you'll get like privates talking to company commanders and being, well, I don't know, sir, how about this? Like during a planning session. And it's very funny because it's very alien to those of us who are from Western militaries, because that's like the private. Why the fuck are you talking to the captain or to the major? Like, shut the fuck up, man. But it's that Cossack attitude of Cossack mentality, and it can slow down the planning process, but it also can help. You know, sometimes it can help red team it, and other times it's good just to have input, because you sometimes do get. Good input from, you know, from junior guys. I remember we were doing, it's like one of these dangerous encounters with real training that made me think. It was a VanDu officer that came to our regiment after getting out of the regs. And so he'd done a lot of heavy fighting in Afghanistan pre-2014. And it was, you know, it was the first time that I found out what an AAR is. It was the first time that I went on an exercise and actually did real iterative training on an objective where it was like, okay, we're going to do this until we get it right. Like real rehearsals, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Really awesome. And he did something else that I had never seen before. We were coming up we were coming up some stairs. We were in a kill house, and one of the other corporals noticed a gap in the between the floor and the door, because we're getting ready to go in this room. And he's like, hang on. He whispers in the sir's ear, and he gets down and he looks under, and he kind of like, no feet on the ground, you know, from here to here. And it was neat, you know, it's fun. It's, again, it's thinking outside the box. And then later on I forget what we called it, a troop leader, platoon commander. Anyway, whatever. He like praised this corporal. Like, that was a really good idea. I'm glad you brought that up. That was cool. And it was wild, because I'd never seen, you know, he even gave credit to me one time in front of other officers for something that it's funny. They praised him. And he said, oh, no, that was my idea. That was, you know, so-and-so. And it was like, oh, whoa. There's more of that out here. But then again, you know, you also have like the Soviet guys. There was some of our instructors were working elsewhere. I'm not going to say the unit because, yeah. But they went to meet a battalion commander. They'd been training his guys, but the like pretty much a company worth of his guys for, I don't know, a month, 2 months at that point. And they were like, well, we really should speak to this battalion commander. And they went to meet him. And he's in some like CP way back from the line playing fucking Xbox. And he sees him. He's like, what's the problem? You know, why do you want to talk to me? And they're like, well, we just wanted to meet you, sir. And they, you know, we work with some other organizations that do like fundraising, bringing in gear. And they said, and that's what they said to him. They said, you know, we can help get NVGs. We can get first aid kits. We can get all this and that. And he's like, ah, no. He's like, nah, the men are paid well enough. They buy their own stuff. And, you know, so it's not like it's a bed of roses out here. There are these junk officers, you know. Or there was another one. I'll tell that story another time. Okay. But
we're probably going to do a part two, because I definitely have a lot more questions, and we're coming up on 2 hours. So we will be doing a part two. I just made the executive decision.
Jumping, Jesus! It is. Pardon me.
Time flies.
I love this stuff. I have to say, like, it's. I've never had the kind of job satisfaction that I do now. And we don't make any bloody money. We're lucky to have some of our costs, most of our costs covered by our sponsors. But it's still like, you know, we're still volunteers. But it's at the same time, like when I left the Army, I was angry because I felt like I was kind of shortchanged. You know, I never got the chance to do the job for real. Mm-hmm. As I saw it, it's funny enough. One time I expressed this to that officer that I really got on with, and he said, you shouldn't think that way, but I still couldn't help it. But you know, I get to sort of honor the mentors that I had, and I had some really phenomenal, this is the first time that I received mentorship in my life, out from people that weren't relatives is what I'll say. In the Army, you know, and the people that the first time that I had people come and like demand things of me, and then be like, you know, I would meet that demand and it'd be like, okay, cool. Here's the new demand. Okay, cool. Here's the new demand. And they just keep, you know, demanding more of me. And that was huge. That opened me up so much. And I always felt bad. I'm like, am I honoring what these people have passed on to me? You know, yeah, I've trained a lot of people. I spent like 6 of my 10 years. I was always teaching on courses, but I kind of felt unfulfilled in that way. But now I get to take the things that they taught me. I get to resurrect parts of the soldier that they helped build, mm-hmm. and then pass it on to other people who are using it. And it really feels good to be able to do that. And we've got like one of the groups that we spent the longest time with is from the National Guard. They're now in the 1st Brigade. They're involved in pretty heavy fighting. And I keep in contact with one of the, he was a platoon commander. He's now been promoted to a company commander. And from the, it was roughly 100 guys that we worked with. They've been out there in heavy fighting. He sent me a video. I'll send it on to you. It's also on our social media.
Okay.
The Russians with a bunch of infantry riding a tank, they drove into their trench, and then the dismounts all came out, the crew jumped out, and they started to assault the trench. And there's this amazing video of two of our former students really aggressively working this corner, and you know, grenades going back and forth, and they fucked up all of the one Russian
survived. I saw that video.
And he surrendered. Yeah. And
it was, yeah.
You know, they've been out there for a couple of months now, and we've had to go to one funeral. But of the roughly 100 guys that were out there, I don't like to say it this way, but only 7 have died. And the difference that can be made, because that's a ratio way, lots more have been wounded, but that's a ratio way lower than average out here.
Yeah.
Knowing the difference that can be made by doing relatively simple stuff from our perspective, it makes all the time I spent in like fucking Meaford, you know, or getting beasted on my PLQ out in the field when I'm sweaty and filthy. It justifies all of it. So it's one of the things that I'm glad that in a way, I really, to be honest, I'd pretty much trade anything to not have had this invasion happen, but at least it let me put myself to use, and at least it let me justify the time that I spent learning all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, the sacrifices back then, I can't call them that, but the maybe missed opportunities and time spent not enjoying myself, the injuries, mm-hmm. you know, but it's all worth it now, because we, you know, it's not just me. I couldn't have done any of what I've done without the volunteers and the instructors that we've got, because I know what I know. It's a good amount of stuff, but my training director and my ops director are masters, really, really high tier officers, amazing guys. And you know, our training director, his whole thing in the British Army was doing like battalion level training exercises and training design and a little bit of curriculum design, and a lot more curriculum design now. But you know, like especially when those two came on board, and not to denigrate the rest of the team, but when those guys came on board, it turbocharged things for me, because I could now hand out or delegate certain leadership tasks, and that freed me up to go do other things like you know, chase people for money and to, you know, kind of promote what we're doing. And it's weird, it's rough, because it's, you know, we're an NGO. It's like owning your own business. You got all kinds of costs. We're trying to we need more vehicles. We need more buy-in from our local training partners. We have to, you know, I have to make sure that we're, we got a big pilot course coming up, and we have to show our work, and we're going to be very closely watched. But provided we do a good job, we're going to have a lot of really important doors open for us. And that's going to give me the opportunity to go to certain other places and say to people, hey, just so you know, there's an NGO-led security force assistance mission happening here in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And I know you guys are worried about escalation, but we're already here. We've already been working. A little bit of assistance here and there is not gonna cause the pot to boil over. Mm-hmm. And all of that, everything that we've achieved as an organization has been because of people like Jean, mm-hmm. who are willing to come out here at their own expense and do a full-time job, a demanding full-time job, mm-hmm. for free, out of moral motivation, like moral obligation. And that, you know, and knowing that that work is going to go on to save lives, like it's just, yeah, I don't, you know, I look down on
heart.
People who
it,
are
it fills it, the heart it, does it, with hope.
It does. I was going to say, like, I get frustrated and I look down on people that talk about like, oh, we need a war, that'll sort this and that out. It's like, you don't know what that's like, man. You do not know what that's like. Go watch a mom, like a young mother in her 20s who's just buried her husband who's in his 20s. You know, watch her at a funeral. You know,
go be around death. Yeah. That's what I'm like. Go be around death for a bit, and tell me how you feel about that.
Go to your friend's gravesite, mm-hmm. and then walk back from that and walk past a widow in her 20s. Mm-hmm. Tell me about a fucking war.
Yeah.
You know, like that. But knowing that we can put some, you know. Okay, I'll say it like this. I'm going to be as aggressive as I like.
Yeah, fuck.
Knowing that we have the opportunity to tilt the fucking scales so hard that essentially four guys repel a fucking tank that has six dudes riding it, plus, you know, the three or four in the crew. Knowing that we can bring them the knowledge and the confidence and the aggression that lets them overcome that, it's big, you know. Yeah. And so. I'm fortunate that I had the mentors that I did and the people helping me that I do, that lets our organization have the impact that it does. And so, you know, again, I'll tell you right now, I'd rather this invasion never happened and I opened a bakery, because that's what I was thinking. I really like baking cookies and brownies, and I was really fixed on that. Saving up enough money to start that. And unfortunately things went another direction, but at least I get to do something, mm-hmm. you know? So it's a bit scattered, but, I got a little emotional there.
Oh dude, understandably, given where you're at, what you're doing, it would be weirder if you didn't. like I said, I have way more questions. We're at 2 hours here, so we're going to be doing a part 2 coming up. We'll get something on the books, because again, we just scratched the surface of the stuff I want to talk about, and I assume for you as well. We'll be chatting offline here, get something sorted out. But before we call it, the same old question we ask all of our guests: what's a skill or some knowledge in life, and it can be anything. It doesn't have to be shooting, but just anything in life. What's a skill or knowledge that you think people should learn or expand their mind on?
Okay. Big skill is learn to speak to people you don't agree with, and learn when to just be like, you know, however vehemently you disagree, keep it to yourself and let the topic change or something, because, you know, we get so hung up on arguing with one another, and, you know, it will probably rob you of opportunities. And so, you know, learn the times, and you just got to bite your tongue and recognize that you don't have to work with everybody. And if there's someone that you really can't get along with, you don't need to have words with them. You just don't need to hang out with them. You don't need to work with them. And so, learn to talk to people that you disagree with.
I like it, man. We're 50 episodes in now, and we've had 50 great pieces of advice. Before we officially stick a pin in it, also, Kevin, where can they find you? Learn more about you. Plug yourself and your organization for a minute.
Perfect. Yeah. So our website is www.sabertag.org. Sabertag.org. And our Instagram, that's like our most active social media, saber_TAG. Very simple. We're not like wildly active on there, but we're getting better because I've got a good, we've got a good social media manager now. But that isn't me. But Sabertag everywhere. Sabertag.org, saber_tag on Instagram.
Beautiful. Dude, thank you very much for coming on. Look forward to talking to you again soon in the next coming days. And for you, the listener, go drink some water and go do some dry firing.